Light on, mic on. Okay. Yeah. All right, we're good. You suppose we've started? He closed the door, so I'll assume that we're now broadcasting. Good evening. This is the January 2009 meeting of the Health Commission, and Happy New Year to everybody. So the first order of business will be the approval of the minutes of our December 8th meeting. Are there any corrections or additions that need to be made to those minutes? There being no official corrections or changes or additions. Motion to accept the minutes as written with typos corrected.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. There being no objection, the minutes are approved as written. Next comes the public comment period. This is the time when anybody who wants to make a comment on subjects that are not on our agenda may come forward. But I don't see anybody out there, so I guess we won't have any public comment. All right. Then we will move on to the first item on our agenda, which is Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster, VOAD, the Medical Volunteer Program. And we have Elizabeth Merson, from the Emergency Services Director from the Red Cross here. Welcome, Elizabeth. Can you just come, either one?
Well, I was asked to come today to speak about two programs that the American Red Cross is working on. The first is Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster, and since that's a long title, we just call it VOAD. It's a program that started about 2 years ago when we received grant funds from PG&E to help start this program. It's a program historically that started on the national level back in the 60s when there was a hurricane, Hurricane Camille, and all of the big disaster response players got together afterwards and said, you know, we could have had a much better response to this disaster if we had worked together and weren't acting as individual agencies responding in our own little bubbles. So they got together and decided to form VOAD on a national level so that their agencies would work beforehand to get to know one another, kind of designate different roles for each other so that when a disaster happened, they could work more efficiently together. As time went on, things did get better on the national level, but they decided it needed to be made more local. So it went down to the state level, and from there, down to the regional level. So VOAD has been around for several years, several decades now, but it's only been in our county for the past 2 years. So when we received funding, the American Red Cross received funding to get this program started in our county. It had been talked about by other agencies such as 211 Slow Hotline and some other agencies, United Way and such, that we needed to get on this after Katrina. So once we received the funding, we started going out and talking to different agencies, recruiting them. And in that time, we now have 45 different members. They're all nonprofits that have a mission that relates to responding in a disaster, or they could have some sort of response in disaster. So whether that be volunteers that could help other agencies, whether they have trucks to move supplies, whether they can help animals. So we've really come a long way. We have lead agencies for different services. So we have animal lead agencies, which is Woods Humane Society and HEAT, Horse Emergency Evacuation Team. And if there was a disaster where animals would need sheltering or evacuation, they have taken on the responsibility of kind of managing that. We have monetary donations, which is led by the Community Foundation. We have in-kind donations, which one of our churches, Shouts of Grace Church in Grover Beach, has taken on. And I'm forgetting one other one I know. Food. The Food Bank Coalition is the lead agency for any food service providers. But one of the most important things of VOAD is that we have a close relationship with first responders and Office of Emergency Services. We want to partner with them and support their efforts so that we are once again collaborating in a response and not working in our own bubble. But the idea is really that if we combine forces and respond to a disaster together, we'll be much more efficient in our use of resources. So rather than Red Cross serving clients on one corner and Salvation Army serving clients on the other corner, we go, okay, Salvation Army, you go to Arroyo Grande, we're going to San Luis Obispo. And we're more efficient because we're talking to each other and communicating. And so far we haven't had any disasters, so we've had to do simulations and drills. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with all of the drills that are done out at the Emergency Operations Center for the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant, but we've kind of played off of those and done tabletops from them where we will call, and we had one situation where Red Cross, we need to serve 2,000 meals to school kids that have been evacuated. So we phoned up food bank in the drill, of course, and said, you know, how fast can you get us some food to bring over to feed these kids? And so we really got it going, and it's a great system that we have with the leads going down to each of the agencies, and then they call their member agencies and activate them. So VOAD is only activated when the county requests our services. If they cannot fill services within for their own first responders or different governmental groups, then they can turn to VOAD, who has additional resources that can be brought to bear in a disaster. So it's a great program, just collaborating and getting these agencies that haven't talked to each other in this kind of way to kind of get together, get to know each other. We're building relationships and having a much more effective response, at least so far in our drills. So we are hopeful for where that's going. We have still some more stuff to do, but we've established MOUs between VOAD and most of the lead agencies, and we're working to kind of make it more concrete and develop more, but it's off to a great start, and we're really excited about where it's going. Do you guys have any questions about the program? Yeah.
Yes, I'm curious, since we're so geographically huge in this county, are you making sure that there's, you know, some kind of a network or something in each community?
That is one of the strategic goals of VOAD. For instance, our churches. We have one in North County. We have one that's over on the North Coast. We have one in San Luis. We have one in South County. So, and those are all going to be acting as in-kind donation drop-off locations, among other things. So, yes, that is definitely something that we're taking into consideration. And many of the organizations are countywide, and so we're pulling on that to kind of, you know, make it a more cohesive response. Or if they're not, they have partners such as food banks. So they, as a food agency that works with lots of the food services agencies in the county, they're aware of, you know, Grassroots is in South County and Loaves and Fishes in North County. So they have those resources all together, so they knew who to pull from, which reminds me that we have a resource grid for every agency that's a member of VOAD, and it has their mission. So if it's in the middle of the night and you can't remember what an agency was, it's listed right there. We have the resources that they've committed to hopefully being able to provide, whether that's trucks, volunteers, what are the volunteer specialties? Are they from hospice and therefore mental health volunteers, or are they from the animal shelter and have skills to deal with small animals? Then we have a 24-hour point of contact. So who can we call in the middle of the night when a disaster happens, because they often don't happen 9 to 5 when everyone's at work. And then we have a backup contact, so that if that person's out of town, we have someone else that has the authority to activate that agency and their resources to get it going.
Okay, well, specifically I'm thinking of some of our areas like San Miguel and Chandon and Cambria, these kinds of very outlying areas. Are they being included in this planning process?
We have outreach to many agencies. I'm trying to think specifically in those areas. We have, I work with the school districts in Chandon, and so we kind of have a connection that way, but that is an excellent suggestion to work on those more, to be honest. But we do have some in Cambria.
Okay, yeah, because we find that the agencies really don't, their outreach doesn't usually get out to those communities, but within those communities there's usually some organization, even if it's a service organization, mm-hmm. like the Lions or somebody, and it seems to me that those would be, they should be included in this
Definitely.
Larger planning process.
Definitely. Yeah, if we can get the word out to anyone, you know, that has an interest. It is hard because we are dealing with nonprofits who have a ton on their plate already, and so to add another meeting and another commitment can be overwhelming, especially if they're a small agency. So they may think the idea is great, but actually doing the work and everything is a struggle for many of us, and we recognize that because we have so much on our plates, all of us. Yes?
In Cambria, there's a CERT, C-E-R-T,
mm-hmm.
the Emergency Response Team.
Through the fire department, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you already know about that.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be your contact point? Maybe you've contacted them already?
Yes, I have a presentation to them in a few months. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Where did you say your initial startup funding came from?
PG&E. And then we got additional grant funding from United Way and the Community Foundation.
And how long will that carry you?
We just got, I believe, another grant for this next year from PG&E. So it was initially a 3-year grant, and so we're going into year 3. Any other questions before I move on to the next program? From the audience? Linda's part of the program. Okay. The other program is the Medical Volunteer Program. And this is a collaboration as well between the SLO County Office of Emergency Services, the Public Health Department, and the American Red Cross. Red Cross has a very close relationship with County Office of Emergency Services, and so we were talking to them about the need for more nurses for Red Cross, and they were talking about the need for more health services for their programs as well. And so we kind of came together and came up with this new program, and it's based off of the Medical Reserve Corps, which is a state program that recruits health professionals to be pre-registered and pre-trained so that they can respond to an emergency. A lot of times, you know, a disaster hits and then everyone wants to help, but it's really hard if you don't have the training. They can't be utilized to the full extent that they would like to be utilized. So we're hoping that through this program, people can take training ahead of time so that their skills will be used more efficiently. So we have developed a program. We have a whole manual, requirements, training requirements, guidelines, and everything for the program. And as of, I believe, last summer, we started recruiting people for it and offering orientations and getting it rolling. We now have 4 fully qualified volunteers for the medical volunteer program, and we have many more in the pipeline. As one of the handouts shows, there are quite a few training requirements, so it is a time-consuming, or it's a real commitment to take on. It's not something just to be taken on in a flash to get done. But the whole point of it is, if there was a public health emergency in the county, all of our healthcare systems are going to be so overloaded. We're going to need more people than we currently have at the hospitals, at the public health department. So the idea is to bring in volunteers that would be willing to help out, to fill in and just help, especially in a public health emergency when many of our workforce may be sick themselves, and so even your regular numbers aren't available, or your regular staff isn't available to respond. So the more people we can get in the system to kind of fill those gaps and help with the surge capacity of all the programs that will be going on, the better. So these volunteers are going to be going through first the Red Cross training, so they have a background in emergency response and what the American Red Cross mission is. And then they're going to be going through medical volunteer program requirements, and that's where they learn about incident command system, the county's emergency plan, as well as there's an online class for working in a point of distribution, because that's a very likely place that these volunteers will be placed in an emergency. And so through that, they will gain kind of this training to understand what goes on in emergencies and be able to fill in as needed. One of the key things is that American Red Cross has certain limitations to what health providers can do in an emergency. Our liability insurance really only covers first aid and basic care. So when volunteers go through the medical volunteer program requirements, they are then become California, forgive me if I get this wrong, disaster worker volunteers. And they're then covered under the county and the state's insurance. So they can practice to the full extent of their license. Whereas they cannot do that as an American Red Cross volunteer. They have to follow the American Red Cross Health Services protocols. So this will allow them to respond in an extended way during a disaster, which includes giving vaccinations, which may be a really needed service in the event of a pandemic flu or other health emergencies. So it's a way to kind of bring health professionals into an organized group so that they can use their skills during an emergency and kind of give them an outlet. And to we don't want to just have them respond to a disaster. We want to keep them engaged during non-disaster times because, as we know, that's most of the time. So we've had them work in drills. When the county recently put on a first responder point of distribution drill. Our medical volunteer program volunteers were there giving vaccinations to all the first responders and their family members. So that was a way to kind of keep them involved. We'll offer extended trainings to keep them engaged. And just various things to kind of hopefully build a cohesive group and make it be almost a social event as well, or anything that will kind of keep them engaged, because I think it's a really important program to have in place if there is a public health emergency, especially in our county. So it's a fair, this one's a newer program, just started, as I said, actually getting volunteers in it over the summer. And so we're offering orientations, which are put on by Tracy Vardis of the Office of Emergency Services and Christine Gager, who's with the Public Health Department. So they give the orientation to the program, but it is Red Cross that's administering it and coordinating all the volunteers and tracking them and making sure that they're going through the requirements. Yes?
Are you overwhelmed with volunteers?
Unfortunately, no.
Okay. Well,
I wish we were, but no, that has not been the case. Right now, we have mostly pulled from our current Red Cross volunteer and those that would qualify for the program. Although we can have auxiliary staff that can do administrative type support, the real focus and push is for those medical volunteers. So,
I don't know how you would go about it, but it seems to me we have a great supply of retired physicians in our mm-hmm. county who don't have a medical license because it costs $850 and there's no reason to have it.
Mm-hmm.
If there was some way that, you know, you could use emergency retired physicians in that position after they've been trained, you know, I'm not sure the steps you go through, but there must be a way to do it, and you could tap into a great source, I think.
I wish that we could, but to my knowledge, I know at least for Red Cross, you have to be currently licensed, and that's for liability reasons, as it seems most things are these days. And I'm pretty sure the same is true for the county, because they are allowed to practice within the scope of their licensure. So if their licensure isn't up to date, then they're not covered under liability.
Well, I realize how it is now, but I'm just saying that, you know, if you will never be overwhelmed, because everyone who has a license is very busy, and
exactly.
And you know, but I think if there was some way or somehow you can look into it and see if there's possibility. I mean, anything's possible.
But aren't there other positions besides medical doctor that these retirees could fill? I mean, they don't have to be practicing physicians in order to volunteer, I wouldn't think.
No, there is auxiliary staff, which would just help. You know, for instance, we have the drill with the first responders, and we gave vaccinations. There was people that were greeters and were helping with the medical paperwork that they had to fill out, and that didn't require a license. So there's definitely positions for non-currently medical licensed personnel.
Is there a category for provisional?
I'm not familiar with that.
That means like a doctor would come from out of state and certain hospitals would give them provisional privileges. I mean, if you know that they're in good standing when they retired, that if, you know, there's a category that is out there that they could practice, you know, limitedly. Maybe Dr. Craven has one.
I can answer that. There is only one state in the union that allows that. That's Tennessee. Otherwise, you have to have a California license.
My question is about the need for translators. Have you made any provision for training translators?
That is one of the auxiliary staff that we have been working with. I'm trying to think. There were some others that are key personnel that do not have medical license that would be of extreme help, and translators is definitely one of them, for sure. Yeah.
I'm wondering if this medical program in the future, is it going to dovetail then with VOAD or be a part of VOAD so that that kind of augments that
situation? It's definitely
situation.
A resource that could be used through VOAD. VOED has to be an agency itself. It can't be just individuals coming to volunteer. You have to, VOED is like an umbrella agency, so the organizations are a part of VOED. So I would have to kind of rethink, since the MVP program isn't an organization really of itself, how that would logistically fit in. But I'm sure that they would be part of the response because we'd be working closely with county, and all of the VOED partners would be kind of in that response. So
it seems
it would
like
be all very tied together for
sure. Yeah, their expertise would be excellent in that regard.
Definitely.
Well, aren't they kind of under the auspices of the Red Cross?
Yeah.
And Red Cross is a VOED member.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they can be, MVP would be activated by the public health officer or his or her designee, as well as Red Cross can activate them. So they're all, we'll all be talking and working together, so they'll definitely, if needed, be activated, and I'm certain they will be. So, yes, definitely. Anything else I can answer about either program? Or any more helpful suggestions would be great as well.
I don't have any suggestions, but I just, for anybody that's listening, the Red Cross is a fabulous organization. I'm a Red Cross volunteer.
Yay.
Haven't had to do much, but I am one of those people that's in the pipeline for the medical volunteer program, and so if you do have a license, please give the Red Cross a call, because it's really, their programs are interesting, they're fun, and very useful.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me and letting me speak this evening. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Okay, we'll move on to the next item on our program. Linda McGregor is here from the 211 hotline. Welcome, Linda.
Hi. You'll forgive me if I whine a little. I'm used to when I'm up here begging for money, so I could revert to that at any moment. I have a handout for you, and it's basically my presentation. You can follow along, and you can... There's probably some extras there. And I have some hotline brochures for you as well. I'll leave those for you. You can take them if you wish. I know some of the names are familiar, and I think some of you could tell me a little bit about Hotline. You're familiar with the agency. Some of you may not know very much about it, so I'll go through a little bit of the background briefly, and you can ask any questions that you have as I go through. Hotline will begin its 40th year this spring. Established in 1970, it's a confidential service, free to the callers. We refer callers to over 500 programs and services in the county. Local programs are what we use, and we maintain the database for those services in the county. We also provide, and we're unique to many information and referral services, in that we provide support and crisis intervention as well. We use volunteers, again unique. If you look at a model of information and referral services throughout the country, most of them use paid staff. We love our volunteers, especially on the crisis and support calls. Nothing like a volunteer's caring time and attention. We do have paid staff now. This is the first year for our bilingual, our Spanish-speaking callers. There's no way I could guarantee volunteers on duty around the clock to take calls from Spanish-speaking callers, and I have paid staff. And they are from the community, so they can relate to the issues people are calling about. And we have a telecare program for homebound or elderly residents in the county. We will make a daily security call to them. So if somebody would, let's say, be released from the hospital and need some interim follow-up, or if they were just homebound elderly, sometimes we're the only person they talk to. We have one woman, usually we call it a regular time of day, but we have one woman who, she wants us to surprise her. And I said, we're the only one that calls you. She said, I know, but I like the surprise. So we're flexible. It also is a really good connection for others who are homebound to make those calls. So it sometimes is a dual-purpose service. And we had to abandon that for a while because of funding. We just didn't have time and the resources to manage it. But it's back again, and we are looking for people in need of those calls and people that want to do it. It's a great service also for people that have volunteered for a while and are kind of burned out and want a little bit light duty. It will work. All of our funding is local. You know, with all of the stuff that's going on with the state, the good news for us is that we don't get any state funding. It's also the bad news. We have no other sources of funding. Hopefully there will be a 211 bill enacted. There is one in Congress. I don't know with the current economy whether they'll act on it quickly because of the current economy or it'll get lost in other legislation. We also handle calls for many agencies that want to have around-the-clock presence but don't necessarily want to have the doors open all the time or be available all the time. So we take calls for the Women's Shelter, the Homeless Shelter, Foster Care Network. This year we added Foster Care Network and Child Welfare Services. And soon we will be adding SARP, the sexual assault line. And in real tiny letters, I have therapists, because most of them have us on their recorder. Very few of us even make a donation. Very few of them even make a donation. The other agencies we have contracts with. Therapists, we cannot force them. And so we just had a direct mail campaign. We sent out a mailer, as everybody does at the end of the year, and we did a special letter to the therapist, and we got some response. But most of them have us on their answering machine if they're not available. Our service contracts are really helping to build our sustainability. When we take calls for after-hours services, we're lowering their costs. And we're, in fact, building a way so that we're not on the dole and asking for grants with other agencies. So I think it's helpful, and it's been helpful for us to get grants because we're getting matching funding. And hopefully in time, I believe that Hotline can really be a source of its own sustainability. It'll take a while, but I hope that will happen. This year we're taking calls for ARP, and we're doing senior tax scheduling. And I just signed a contract with PG&E, and we will be offering the CARE program to our callers. So in this county, there are 35,000 people eligible for utility discounts, and they are not availing themselves of that service. And we will sign them up, and we will get paid for that. So it really is a good service for everybody. And we will be offering food stamps. It's a whole different pay structure and a lot of paperwork, but it's good service to the people that are calling us who are in need. And sometimes the difference between staying in their home and losing it is minuscule. Sometimes the fact that they can do something about it gives them enough energy to do something about it. So if we can be helpful on the call and probe for other things, if they call about needing clothing for the kids, and we can talk to them about other ways to be financially independent or stable, I think that's what Hotline's there for. So the more services that we can offer and also help ourselves, boy, I think that's really a win-win. And the PG&E contract, we're the first 211 ever to be a community outreach center for PG&E. And I think you'll be reading about that pretty soon. And I think we'll actually go out and do outreach and not only wait for calls to come in. The United Way actually started the concept of 211 in Atlanta, Georgia, and it was approved in 2000. No funding, but they approved the concept. They thought it was a great idea to have a 3-digit dialing code for all health and human services. Soon there will be a 3-digit dialing code for public transportation as well, 511. And in fact, we'll be taking their bilingual calls. So if a caller calls for bus routes and they don't speak English, there will be an option on the phone tree. If you need help and you don't speak English, I hope it'll be in Spanish, you'll be connected to 211. And we'll have a little contract with them to take their Spanish-speaking calls. In some cases, Spanish-speaking callers will get better service because after hours, there's nobody to take the English-speaking calls. At least initially, they don't have money for us to take those calls. But ultimately, they will. So 511, and we'll do some joint marketing with them because I think it'll confuse the public. They don't even, some of them don't know about 211. Now there's 511. So we're saying 911 for emergencies, 211 for all other human services, and 511 for public transportation. I hope it's in that order, but we'll see. So we'll be doing some joint public service announcements. 211 is moving along throughout the state. We were the last county in Southern California, except Imperial County, and they have no intention of putting in 211. San Diego will probably take their calls. We were the last in Southern California. There's still some Northern California counties that don't have it. Smaller population. The big population counties all have 211. About 75% of the country has it. And we've had it a year now. So I think we have some real results. We have a year's worth of 211 results. It's the same hotline with three-digit dialing. There's a few exceptions. I think access is easier. We converted to a different database. You can go online through our website, www.slowhotline.org, and you can access our database. Our hotline volunteers use a slightly different version, same data, and you can go in and access that database and have access to the human service directory in this county. If you're dealing with somebody that has a problem, you could have them access that database and get some help. I rather them call hotline because sometimes they don't know what they're looking for. Or they may be needing more than one thing. And sometimes it helps to talk with somebody to sort through that. But a lot of people don't like to call or they don't want to talk to anybody. Sometimes they'll access it and they'll start looking through things and they'll find services on their own. So that database is available. The great thing about our new database is it can be changed immediately. You know, we publish a human services directory and we still publish that directory and people still want it. They like that hard copy. But the database can be updated immediately. So if an agency adds a new program, if French Hospital is having breast cancer screening, boom, it can be on there. If they choose to list it with us, we can put it on and we can take it off when it's over. Seasonal things, like dinners for Thanksgiving or Christmas, we can add immediately. The other advantage is that in disasters, the 211 databases are uniform throughout the state. So if we should get a surge of calls for some reason, let's say there was a fire, and we couldn't handle them all here, we can overflow, let's say to Santa Barbara or Ventura or Los Angeles or Orange County, as far as we need to get help taking calls. And they can access our database and give current local information. If we were shut down, we could totally forward. If I couldn't get volunteers into our center, I could close the doors and send all calls. My preference would be to take them locally if I could, but if I couldn't, I can send them away. We were taking calls in Los Angeles and San Diego for the recent tornado or storms that they had in New Orleans. So we can help each other, and that's a great advantage. When there were the fires in Santa Barbara, we got a lot of people calling us to find out if their parents were okay, Cal Poly students. In San Diego, the same thing. You know, California is a small community, really. Everybody's from somewhere else. So people would call us to see. We had one student at Cal Poly from Rancho anyway, San Diego somewhere, and she wanted to know if her family home had been evacuated. She was trying to call her parents, and their cell phone, they weren't answering. And we could tell her that that block had been evacuated and what center they were sent to. So that was real important information, because she had, we could give her the number of the center, and she could call there and see if her parents were there. I don't, you know, we never know what happens, but that's the kind of information you can give. So that's extremely helpful in times of a disaster. You know, when we were bringing 211 into the county and we had to do our own fundraising to bring it in, we said 211 would be helpful in a disaster, and we didn't expect that the disaster would be financial. And the lion's share of the work we have done this last year has been a response to this financial, the negative financial impact. And we have been hit very hard in the last few months. Beginning in August, our calls doubled immediately. We took 2,000 calls in the month of August. And it has been, it slowed down a little bit over the holidays, but it has been extremely busy. As you can see, our calls are up in the whole year, 62%. And we did, when we launched in November, we did no very little advertising. We advertised that we launched 211, and because the cellular carriers didn't equip cell phones, and this is a college town, we didn't do a lot of advertising. When they equipped the cell phones in July, we started running our PSAs a lot. Our calls, on average, are up 62%, but since August, they're up 105%. We took 18,000 calls through November. I don't have the December numbers completed yet, but I'm estimating at least 20,000 calls this year. Last year, we took 11,300. So business is booming. As you can see, the requests for food and financial assistance are up over 100%. Legal assistance, and that's all about housing, renters' rights, housing. A lot of people are trying to get on the Section 8 list. Senior issues. Most of the seniors, or many of the seniors in this county, if they're not worried or impacted directly, their children are. Or somebody in their family is in foreclosure or needing help. And they are watching TV a lot, and so then they're worrying a lot. And we've had more than 2,400 shelter calls. It's interesting, there's 2,500 homeless people in this county, and we've had 2,400 calls. 1,600 calls for just miscellaneous that don't fit into a specific category. And I've put this in bold print. The stress is building. Substance abuse calls, 32%. That has not been a very high category for us over the years, substance abuse in this county, at least calls about it. I'm not saying it hasn't existed. I'm saying people haven't called about it. 2,000 domestic violence and abuse calls. I will tell you, our calls in the Spanish, from the Spanish-speaking community, have increased 150% this year. We took 62 calls from Spanish-speaking people in all of 2007. We've taken 210 this year. When we go out and do outreach, one of my bilingual staff members went out to a ESL class in Napomo, and she said, I was connecting, I knew it, and I knew exactly when they were making eye contact and what issue they were going to call about. And by the time she drove from Napomo to our office here in San Luis Obispo, she had two messages. And when she made calls, indeed, and that afternoon she had four additional calls. So there is a need in the Hispanic community for hotline. The confidentiality is attractive. And the fact that people are bilingual and are natively bilingual It's not somebody that speaks Spanish like I do. Awkwardly, it is attractive, and it will continue to grow if we do outreach. Mental health issues, 1,100 people calling about those issues. On top of those calls, 500 people called that we referred to various counseling services, transitions, Cal Poly, people that do counseling. 1,000 people just call to talk about stuff. Oftentimes, we get callers that are already in the mental health system and they're needing support between visits, or their meds have changed, or a little crisis has happened, or a big crisis, and they talk with us between visits. Some of them are not in the system and should be, and some of them are just people that are having a temporary tough time. And it says that we have 110 suicidal calls. I can tell you that in the last little while, we have had a ton of them. Some of my hotliners are telling them under mental health, if they're not really crisis suicidal, and we just talked with them about that. Our suicidal calls are different than they used to be. They're raging, screaming suicidal calls. And life at Hotline is changing. When I say we're tracking with the national INR studies, I would, and it's nothing to joke about, but sometimes if you don't joke, it's kind of tough. And I would say even our suicidal callers are starting to complain. And that's not untrue. We had a suicidal caller call back to complain. And life is tough, but part of the issue, and this was disclosed to me through a national study that the Information and Referral Service did, we're all in the same boat. We have first-time and newly poor first-time callers. Their expectations are different. These people have not been in the social service system. So when they call, they want service. They want solutions. They want to get on that Section 8 list for housing. Hello, it's 2 years long. They are less able to navigate the social service system. There's a frustration there. There's fewer resources available now. There's a lot of services that are just not available. And when you have higher expectation, lower satisfaction, higher stress levels. So things are different. A lot of younger people are poor. Things are happening. People that were very comfortable and successful, suddenly the bottom fell out. So I don't want to give you the impression that all our callers, I mean, we still get people that say, oh, thank you so much for being there. In fact, a lot. And a lot of people that have called Hotline for the first time said, I wish I'd known you were there months and months ago. But we have had some people, suicidal people, just raging at us, saying, I don't want you to ask me questions. Just give me an answer. Just give me a number. Well, we can't know where to refer you until we know where you are in this process. You know, we don't know whether to give you a referral or send somebody to you. So it's an interesting world, and I'm glad we're there. I think in many cases, people come to us when they've exhausted other possibilities. But sometimes they come to us when they haven't gone anywhere else. And so we can get them to the right place, and in some cases we can help them look for alternatives. So, what questions do you have? Oh, good. I'm going to slip over and get my water, but I will.
Yes, I was, you said cell phones, all of them now, if they dial 211 on a cell phone in San Luis County, work. Mm-hmm. Excellent. I want to congratulate you on an outstanding presentation. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I was wondering what kind of training your volunteers get. How do you bring them up to speed to deal with all of these issues?
Well, you know, if I said, it makes it easier to understand that they're not professionals when I say that we don't give advice. We allow the person to make their own decisions about the action they take. We often encourage them, and we're all about healthy choices. So we do give about 80 hours of training and lots and lots of on-the-job coaching and observation. And more lately, we are desperate for volunteers, and we're especially desperate for volunteers, more mature volunteers. We get a lot of Cal Poly students. And they are really good volunteers. The ones we get are exceptional, but they turn over quickly. And when you give 80 hours of training, it's rough when they turn over fast. And, you know, in the old hotline days, we wouldn't take them because the payback wasn't good. Now, in the new days, we need them. And, you know, the best of all worlds is a good mix of people. And you learn from young people, and you learn from more experienced people. But we need some more experienced people to get a cadre, a stability. And so we need volunteers. But we do lots of training, and the great thing about having the bilingual people to actually have staff in the call center is there's somebody that's there 8 hours a day, and so they can help do the training. And so they get lots. And, you know, the hardest part about Hotline is, what if I didn't give them all the right resources? And if they call back. You know, you can only hope if you make a mistake, they'll call back. But that's the biggest fear. But 80 hours gives you lots of training.
Thank you.
You have all local funding. Is that county and cities all over the county?
Yeah. When we started Hotline, 211 funding, we established a steering committee. And Jerry Lenthal from the Board of Supervisors and Tim Williams, the chair of our board, co-chaired our steering committee. And that was extremely helpful. I promised Jerry he wouldn't have to work, no heavy lifting. Boy, did I lie. And he was extremely helpful in helping us fundraise. And the county has been, they're our best supporter. And we have been lucky to get good grants from the county. Cities, here and there. This year, I've been doing better because we're more established, and I think the word's starting to spread. It's working, and I'm on the road, you know, giving the story. And it is a compelling story, I think. When you start talking about this economy and what's happening, I think it's important that we're there. We've had some private donations. PG&E has been extremely generous. I mean, PG&E. And Rabobank. And we have some private funders. The first donors to 211 are a couple in Arroyo Grande. He's a retired vet. He said, this is what people need. And so they were, you know, our very first funders. So that's how it was done. Mostly nickels and dimes.
I was surprised at the amount of financial calls. I guess I never thought about calling 211 to ask you about my portfolio, but what is a sample question?
Portfolios are not discussed.
Oh, okay.
And believe me, with my portfolio, yeah, they're calling to find out about utility assistance. They're calling to find out, you know, you can get rental assistance once. Salvation Army will help. They're calling to find out what they can do, how long they can, where they can find some money. How can they get some gas money somewhere? So they ran out of gas. So all of those, believe me, portfolios are never mentioned.
Linda, has there been any feedback about the decrease in calls to 911 with the established of 211?
You know, Pam, we don't talk about that. Someday I think we will. initially, when 211 was started, there was a whole lot of talk about cost justification. You lower one, you increase another, and there are some cost trade-offs, but jobs are involved when you talk about that. And so you must be very, very careful about and be precise about specifically how many calls are moving. And so I don't know. I imagine that there are calls that are transferred over. They don't online transfer, or that I know of. And so I don't know. I would imagine. I know last year in the grant process, they did not get funding, and I got more funding. But I don't know what that was about. I would imagine we are reducing their calls. I do know Chief Lisa Solomon is on our board from Paso PD. And, you know, a lot of the cities take their own 911 calls. It's not all done at the sheriff's office. And she welcomes a reduction in calls because some of those calls tie up the call board. It's one thing to want to get calls. It's another when somebody calls you and says, I'm so lonely, and you have two people, two dispatchers, or one on overnight. You know, you don't want that call, and it's not appropriately placed. So it's one thing to want to keep people. It's another to say that's not a good use of service. So I suspect, and it's hard to justify it when they're spread all over. You know, every PD, not every PD has their own dispatch, but a lot of them do. So it's hard to figure out what the difference is. But she would say that it's a costly proposition when inappropriate calls come to police dispatch through 911. And they should go to 211. And she volunteered to be on our board. So I think she and people like her will be the key to sorting that out. It has to come probably from the 911 side.
I brought it up simply because I remember when the start of 211 came before the Health Commission, that was part of the dialogue was decreasing the unnecessary calls to 911 and diverting them to 211.
Yes. And I think that is the dialogue. It's decreasing the unnecessary calls rather than putting a dollar amount or a person amount on it, because we don't know. And again, it's pretty hard to determine when they're all spread out in little centers like that. They're looking. I can tell you that there has been a lot of discussion as we begin to look at managing 211s more efficiently. You know, we've been around 2 years now. It's time to take a look. And we've been talking about things that can, you know, I came from Pac Bell, and so I watched decentralization and centralization, and I think there are lots of things you can centralize to economize. And as we begin to talk about databases and things like that, and we've been looking at 911 to see things like their phone systems, and they're looking at stuff to centralize and economize too. And I think as they do, some of this will be looked at again.
Do you refer some of your mental health calls to NAMI,
yes.
National Association for the Mental Health?
Yes. Most we refer locally to local mental health, and we use the mental health crisis team locally a lot on suicide calls.
Well, there is a local chapter of NAMI.
Yes. We have a pretty close relationship with our mental health group. We have a lot of frequent callers, and we know about them, and we have a relationship with mental health so that we better understand them. And on suicide calls, we find that some of them mental health has dealt with. We had a recent suicide call. A real suicidal person who mental health had intervened with the week before, or 2 weeks before they had actually attempted. So there's...
I guess when I ask about NAMI, I was thinking of the families. It's very hard to cope with a family member who is mentally ill.
Yes.
And they do a great deal of support and training so that family members can understand
right.
what this person's going through and what they as family can do about it.
really important. And, you know, that's a question I encourage hotliners. I'm glad you brought that up, Don. That's a question that is really important for hotliners to ask. I just heard a hotliner ask the question the other day, and it just so pleased me. They said, well, now that we have your husband's needs taken care of, can I ask, what about you? And I thought, that's the best question, because whoever asks you that? You know, that's the kindest question that you can ask somebody, because often the caregiver is calling to take care of somebody, and the person really on the phone is having a really difficult time. And I'm hoping that we're listening for that, because often that person is really going through a tough time and needs some help. Sometimes that day isn't the right time. And so they need to encourage them, call back when you have a moment, and we'll take care of getting you a referral as well.
Yes, along that line, I know that's an issue that at North County we run into, that most of our calls come in from family members when they're looking for help with substance abuse. And so I'm glad to hear that you're encouraging them, because we always try to say the same thing, and what are you doing for you, and here's the types of support groups that are out there for the family. Because we often can't intervene with the person who's actively using, but we can sure intervene with that family member and get them support.
Yeah, sometimes it's more difficult on the telephone. When people come to you in person, maybe they expect to spend a little more time with you, or you can see them and all the nonverbals, and maybe you have a little better time. Sometimes they don't want to do that on the phone, but you always ask. And even if they don't deal with it then, maybe they will call back. And hopefully at the end, we end the call by saying, and please call us if there's anything else we can do. You know, you plant that seed, so.
And I did want to mention that the calls may be down for you around substance abuse, but I think that's because there are some other resources out there in the community that deal directly with substance abuse. And one of the things that I've noticed over the past, during this past year, I don't know when exactly they started, but I know that the local AA and Al-Anons now have public service announcements on TV that are giving their hotline numbers finally, so people can call them directly, or they're going to the phone book to call them directly, or they call some of the other resources out there directly. But I do know that we used to, and we still do receive calls,
yeah.
Referrals from hotline.
And I think during these times, that kind of thing just gets worse and worse. It's interesting when I've been talking to the cities, because the CDBG grant process is alive and well, and it's interesting when you look at the call patterns for each city. In some cities, you know, it's domestic violence is up, and others it's substance abuse, and every city has different calling patterns, and it's just interesting to look how there's different things. Some of it is a function of what services are available in that city, or people are more aware of, you know, if they know there's a center in the city, they're more likely to call, but it's very, very different. And I like to tell them, you know, well, in your case, domestic violence isn't up, but substance abuse surely is. And they're like, oh, that's, you know, they're interested to know specifically. And we didn't used to give them as much data by city, but now they're very, very interested in specifically how the trends are impacting them. And I think that's something that we can do. We have a grants in now to try and get better data, and data specific to each city, and also data specific to the agencies we're referring to. So we can track, when people call in, what agency did we refer to? And then we can do some follow-up, quality follow-up, to find out, did we do a good job? And also, when we referred you, could that agency help you? So at the end of a year, we'll have some great data that says, how are we doing, but what do we have unmet needs in the county? You know, are there times we have 20 places to refer to, and are there times we have none? And when they call, although we have referrals, are the needs being met? I mean, it's not us tracking other agencies. It's more about needs than for the agencies and quality. So I'm sure I've told you more than you need to know.
Could you give us the web address again for the data bank?
Yes, and it is on the cards, but it's www.slowhotline.org. And if you have any trouble when you're going through it, you can call the hotline office and ask for Amy. She's our database specialist, and she'll help you.
Thank you so very much. I have to echo Commissioner O'Dell's praise of your presentation. It really was very thorough and very interesting, I'm sure, to all of us, and I learned a lot from what you had to say. And for people who are listening, they need volunteers for 211. So if you're interested in that, please get in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you so very much. All right, moving on our agenda, the health agency report. Dr. Bornstein is here to give us her report.
Lots of money, is that what you said? Yes, that's what's going on these days. The money is just flowing in. Oh, I worked really hard to try to think of something positive to say tonight. And I may yet get there, but we're very enmeshed in budgets, locally, state, watching what's happening at the federal level, and that seems to consume a lot of my time and what's going on. There's a few items I wanted to bring to everyone's attention that are, you know, perhaps more remarkable than the general economic malaise that we are under and the extreme difficulty at the state level, even beyond the general economic downturn. And with that comes some very extraordinary responses that we're hearing out of the state to deal with the current and additional deficit that's being projected for the coming fiscal year that begins in July. One thing that just hit my inbox shortly before I came here was a proposal to withhold reimbursement to local jurisdictions beginning in February for Health and Human Services, basically Medicaid, as well as other types of state-funded support for human services. And the dollar amount associated with that for the six-month period, they're actually looking at crossing fiscal years, and so that retaining the cash flow from February 1st through September 1st is close to $3.5 billion that would be held back in terms of the state's inability to make those payments to local jurisdictions. I just did a very quick and dirty. I know what our population size is in the Medicaid population in our jurisdiction, and this is very rough, so don't quote me on it, but I just wanted to get some sense in my own mind of what we might be looking at, and came up with something on the order of $50 to $60 million. Over that six-month period. So if you recall, I've been here before you telling you about the county's looming deficit going into the next fiscal year of $22 million, which is pretty sizable for this jurisdiction. It's unprecedented to think about that kind of lack of cash flow into the health system, and that amount for this jurisdiction really dwarfs the county deficit that we're looking at. So stay tuned. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of dialogue. CSAC is already taking a very strong position against this action, and you know, we'll keep us all tuned in. One of the other things that has been put forth in the governor's budget that is very near and dear to our hearts in the human service industry is the proposal to reallocate first five funds to other needs in the state, be they transportation, law enforcement, what have you, for the general fund budget balancing needs. And so if you recall, first five is the state Proposition 10 that has been in place for almost a decade now to fund services for children birth to five. And what is being proposed is that the state funding that supports the state commission and state programs would be eliminated in its entirety, and that the local funding would be halved. So that would be a very significant impact to this county. First Five, I happen to also sit as a First Five commissioner, does one of the largest things that money funds is the Children's Health Initiative. And so the children between ages 0 and 5 who are not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid or even the SHIP program, the Healthy Families, can get insurance, or some who are poor enough but are undocumented, would be the greatest impact would be on that program, because that receives the greatest amount of funding currently from First Five. And there are a number of other programs that support breastfeeding, that support, you know, smoking cessation for pregnant mothers, early education, school readiness, and there's a whole host of things that are funded with that money. So I also wanted to bring that to your attention. And otherwise, in terms of the budget, our budget is due to the County Administrative Office first week in February, and we are submitting what is a status quo budget, meaning if we change nothing from what we're doing right now, what would the additional cost be? And then we will be asked to turn around and deal with that additional cost by developing a list of what we would cut to bring us back to our current level of funding, and actually possibly a little bit less than that. You know, we, like everybody, is just hoping that something's going to break soon in the economy and things will turn around and these projections will be inaccurate. I know the county is looking at rainy day funding, but that was tapped last year, so it's substantially down. And, you know, there aren't a lot of answers to all these challenging questions, but I will certainly keep you and the public tuned in.
Dr. Bornstein, before I came over, I had a California Medical Association alert that claimed that Anthem Blue Cross had dropped Healthy Families in five counties, Santa Barbara, Monterey. It wasn't our county. Have you heard anything about that program, maybe tanking?
I have not here. I don't know. There's a lot of unprecedented things happening these days.
There was some talk of raiding the Mental Health Services Act funding. Is that still being discussed?
Yes, absolutely. And I, speaking on behalf of the health agency, I neglected to point out, since that, in behavioral health, they're very much concerned and looking at, much like First Five is being looked to as a source for potentially filling the budget gap at the state level. The same is true for Prop 63, which funds the Mental Health Services Act. That's a tax on the very wealthy in California that supports a very aggressive mental health outreach and treatment effort in our mental health department. Both of those, I should have noted, would require a voter initiative in order to change, because currently those propositions, having been voted in by the voters, would have to be, the funding sources to be used for general funds would have to again be approved by the voters. So there are a lot of unknowns.
You said that's for First Five too? They have to go to the voters?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh. Yes. I know the Mental Health Act would, but...
Yeah.
So. Just in perspective, and where are we in terms of the rest of the country? Because we're suffering from these dire circumstances. Are we out there, amongst your colleagues, do you have any feel for how we are in relation to the rest of the country?
Well, I recently have spoken to a couple of buddies who work for State Health Department back on the East Coast, and, you know, they're experiencing many of the same things, but not at the level that we're hearing. And, you know, as someone new to the area who's getting used to the proposition method of democracy and the two, you know, the supermajority needed to pass a budget. You know, I think it is really presenting additional extraordinary challenges for us locally because of the state system that in which we work. You know, many states are doing some type of furlough of state employees, not as much as is California, but that is happening. Many are looking at layoffs, many of the federal and state budgets across the country obviously are trimming back on some of the programmatic areas. But I do think that the cash flow situation that California is facing and the inability to resolve the budget deficit is really a notch above what others are experiencing.
As far as disaster preparedness, does that reach over into fiscal disaster? I mean, what is our plan B in case, you know, hundreds of children are without health insurance and, you know, some of our mental health programs are cut? What do we do?
Very good question. You know, we at our most core responsibilities for public health is, you know, if we had to strip away programs that enhance health, that focus on prevention, that you know, are supportive of people in challenging circumstances like substance abuse, we would still be left for certain as legislative mandates with dealing with communicable disease outbreaks, with taking care of environmental health issues in terms of safe water, safe food, you know, air exposures. You know, but I don't know. I think that people who have been around in public health for decades are feeling a sense of unease that they haven't in their entire careers. You know, we're all living with this sense that we just hope things turn around quickly because, you know, if another few hundred children lose health insurance, if the adults lose their Medicaid benefit package, there's a number of things on that score that are being looked at in the state that adults would no longer have access to many of the benefits that are currently in the package. You know, any long-term care issues, dental, you know, so there's, you know, it's going to be a slow degradation, and, you know, we can just hope that things will turn around in a time frame that will prevent there being really dire consequences from this.
Well, I would highly suggest and beg you at your next disaster preparedness meetings that the dimension is of fiscal disasters is included. Thank you.
Sure.
Is that the end of your report, Dr. Bornstein?
No,
I'm waiting for the good news.
Well, I do have one, you know, thing while this, you know, while Rome burns, I fiddle away, which is I've still been very much focusing and trying to get the word out on some of the prevention opportunities that we not lose those in the midst of hunkering down. And one thing that happened last week was a board retreat of the local, the SLO Medical Association. And I had the opportunity to sit and talk with the board about ways in which we can partner and have greater synergies with the medical community. I've also never seen a group of docs and specialists be so concerned about being able to maintain business. And it's a real issue for them. So we began a dialogue of, I said it's a good day when specialists want to see their business decrease. You know, it's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek statement, but you know, sometimes we in public health look to subspecialists and say it's a perverse incentive that they need the sick people to keep their business going. But actually, I felt a real sense of coming together, you know, radiologists, cardiologists, emergency docs, you know, saying, yeah, we really need to turn this healthcare system around. There really needs to be a paradigm shift. And so we were having discussions about making sure that the docs are aware how we can support them in public health. Like, many at the table didn't know that we offer free smoking cessation classes, that we are looking to partner with pediatricians on measuring obesity and delivering prevention messages through their staff. So those things are going on even while we are looking at some significant budget cuts. So a lot of that just really is about communication, and you don't need money to get the word out. So I've been really trying to focus on that. I did want to get back with you. There were some issues raised the last time, and give you some updates on a number of those things. I know coccidioidomycosis is one of the areas of great concern, valley fever, and a couple of things have happened. One is I now that the year has ended, I've been able to look at the case numbers, and for San Luis Obispo for the year of 2008, we had a total of 81 reports of disease, which is an average number. That's in an endemic area of the country in a population size like ours. That is not terribly surprising. It's average. The good news is that we had no deaths with that disease listed as the primary cause of disease. But three which listed as a contributing factor. So it could be a cardiac arrest was the ultimate listed cause of death, but the cocci was the antecedent. So, you know, using the most conservative estimate, we would say that we had at least three deaths that to which cocci contributed. That's three too many. Again, you know, looking at statistical trends is nothing this year that was out of the ordinary. I know that, you know, prevention is the greatest thing that we want to achieve with respect to cocci. And toward that end, we have had a meeting with the Air Control Pollution District, is that ACPD? Still getting to know my acronyms, and have begun to discuss a number of ways in which we will work with planning to get the word out they at this point are saying they weigh in on all site development plans and make recommendations. So at this point, we're still at the recommendation level for watering down sites prior to site development, but you know, we are still going to begin a dialogue with planning as to whether or not it's feasible to move that into a more regulatory framework. So that's what I can tell you is going on with cocci right now. Yeah.
Yeah, my question is regarding California Valley. As you know, we've had a woman come in twice to complain about cocci out in California Valley. So in those 81, did you get the breakdown of how many of those occurred out of California Valley?
I did. I didn't look at it. I did not bring those numbers with me, but they were proportionate to population. So we had a lot of the cases in the Atascadero area and upgrade. I should have that, and I will get it back to you. I know that I received a call earlier that I haven't been able to respond to. I'm going to do that partially tonight through this report. And additionally, I will make sure that you and the other commissioners get that detailed information. You raised the point that I had offered, I think, last meeting or perhaps two meetings ago. We would be more than happy to spend some extra time going out to California Valley and sitting down with interested community members and talking about the issue and giving them the hard numbers and prevention methodologies and brainstorming in addition to just, you know, an in-service teaching type model. So, you know, I don't know what the natural gathering places are. So I would welcome hearing from Ms. Nolan, I think it was, and anyone else that you want to refer directly to my office, and we will make sure that we make that outreach effort to them if they give us better information on how we would pull communities together.
I have a question on this. Also, when you mentioned outreach through the planning department, have you also done some outreach, say, with Farm Bureau for the different ranchers and maybe dry farmers and people that are out there to connect with them?
Right. We have not as of yet, and I'll certainly make note of that. The other thing that we're doing is we're bringing an intern in-house who can help do some of the groundwork on making these connections, and is particularly going to be looking at the seasonality of not just coxie, but many different infections, seasonality and geographic distribution, is taking good statistics classes so that they're in a position, whereas mine were, probably 20 years ago. We do have an epidemiologist on staff who's also looking at this. I think she's spoken before this commission and could do so again. But we're definitely bringing in some low-cost resources to look at some of these issues again. The other two items that had come before you before that I indicated I'd follow up on is Dr. Beebe, James Beebe, our lab director, had to be out of state today for a national meeting, so he will come to the, I guess, March meeting. And I also had a question raised today about how we handle single case reports of potential food poisoning. He would probably be able to give a much fuller answer to that because it's very complicated. Very few labs in the country are really expert in testing food, so we do very little of that. We've had a couple of situations in recent weeks of individuals who felt that a particular food was causative of disease symptoms, and it's a very technically difficult thing to get food specimens in the right condition for testing and know what to test for and how to test. But again, I think that Dr. Beebe would be a much more articulate presenter on that issue that has come to our attention. The last item was regarding the smoke-free county campus. What has happened in the interim is there has been input from General Services, the Department of General Services, and the county administrative officer that we should, as a health agency, pursue at a minimum health campus policy and look into whether or not we can go countywide with this. So the limiting factor this past month has been me, who is in the process of developing a white paper for county administration to look at the various options of inclusions and exclusions. But at least one department has already been engaged in the dialogue as well. So I know things are not moving fast enough for some advocates, including those on my staff, who still, who run the tobacco control program and say that people smoke outside their door. And, I'm very, very interested in doing something on this score. I was successful in a former life on another coast in getting smoke-free grounds implemented in a county, and I think what we'll be able to, if not whole hog, so to speak, go forward. I predict that incrementally we will get there in this calendar year, and hopefully on the early side of that. The interpretation, again, by legal, is that we will have to do an ordinance as opposed to just a policy, but I don't see that as a stumbling block.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Dr. Vorenstein. You really are doing a fabulous job, and this group really appreciates you, and we appreciate the thoroughness of your reports.
Well, thank you.
Even if they aren't everything we want to hear. But it's quite understandable when you're so enmeshed in the negative dollar stuff that everything else looks grim as well. All right, then. We'll move on our agenda to our updates. The only chair update, I have just a quick blurb on the tobacco-free movement for the outdoor areas in Atascadero. I'm just quoting from in the email that I received that support is needed to show up at the Park and Rec Commission meeting in Atascadero on Thursday, February 19th at 7 p.m. and let them know that you support tobacco-free outdoor areas in Atascadero. You don't have to be from Atascadero to do this because they are working to have as many tobacco-free outdoor areas in our county as possible, and eventually I think they will prevail. It's just a time-consuming process. So that's really all I have to report. We'll start with commissioner updates. Let's start on my left with Commissioner Arnold.
Okay, thank you. I passed out earlier an article by Terry Allen to all of you from Indy Times Magazine.
No money in prevention. And once you've got cancer, you'll pay anything to try to stay alive. Cancer treatment is therefore a booming business, and cancer prevention is nowhere. Also, I want to point out there was an article in the Tribune on the Voices page for Saturday, January 3rd, 2009. It was a viewpoint titled Chemicals, Life Givers, Life Takers. And it was by Al Meyerhoff, who died from complications of leukemia shortly after the article was written. Meyerhoff suggests a rewrite of the Federal Toxic Substances Control Act and phasing out of the worst actors among chemicals. And so if the next time our legislative committee meets, they want to vote for backing this rewrite of the Toxic Substances Control Act, I would welcome that action.
Commissioner Arnold, what exactly is in the works as far as rewriting that act?
Well,
anything?
I don't think the ball has gotten rolling.
Okay.
But if our commission takes a position and then passes it on to the supervisors and they ask our lobbyists in Washington to push it, I feel that's our job. We're to advise the supervisors on health care matters.
I turned off. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I was just wondering if the legislative committee is where we want to do that, or since it is not a piece of legislation at this time, or whether it would be a more generalized where we would. Huh? Education almost seems like that might fall in the education committee, where they could gather information on you know, what the act includes now and what is being proposed by, I didn't actually read that viewpoint, but that by that author and others. So there's a subject for the Education Committee. There we go. Okay.
Thank you.
Several of the agencies and groups with which I'm peripherally involved are concerned about the pending sludge ordinance, and I don't know what I can report about it except that there are some questions as to whether it's written in such a way as to be efficacious. Is that the right? No, that's not the efficacious. Thank you.
Well, it's coming back, I think, for another round of public comment in February, so, you know, I've got years of writings on it and research on it, and
All I can say is I don't want it on the land. I think we'll go from there and probably in, oh gosh, because we're not going to have another meeting until
March.
Okay. Maybe we should agendize just, you know, update in March with Dr. Bourne.
Yeah, I was going to formally tell you that the public comment period was extended such that it ends on February 1st. In the interim, Kurt Basson, our Director of Environmental Health, Jeff Hamm, myself, and a couple of members of planning are looking at what the options are around going forward with making it permanent, looking at any possible revisions and consideration of in the EIR. So we'll have some more to report on that in March, along with all of the comment and update from staff who are looking at the issue.
And this commission has already made comments, so I think
we
on record.
Yeah, we really have.
Okay. Commissioner Hetherington, do you?
I don't have, let's see, the Domestic Violence Task Force meets next week, and I would beg if somebody could sit in on a meeting. They start at 8 o'clock at the DA's office. I have a commitment at work that I can't make. So it's next Wednesday on the 21st. If anybody's free, give me a call.
What time?
Starts at 8 and goes usually till 9.
Yeah.
At the DA's office.
You've been before. So did you get a volunteer?
No.
Oh. Okay. All right. Well, we'll make sure we're covered.
And if not, they'll publish minutes. So.
Okay.
No, while we won't have a meeting in February, that Pam and I will begin our annual on the task force for the preventive health grant. And we do, it's a very concentrated 3 or 4 weeks of time. And it's a very interesting thing to do, and it's very difficult because there's a lot of fine applications and there's not enough money. So, same back thing. But that's what we'll be doing.
I was unable to attend the ASPC meeting, which occurred the first Friday of the month. And so in March, I'll have a report for January, February, and March.
The next Oral Health Coalition meeting is not until February 3rd, and I'll be attending that. I did have one thing I found on researching Coccidio. I knew we were going to discuss it a little bit tonight. There is a drug on, at least in testing, who has been shown to kill the fungus in mice and is beginning to go on humans now. It's called Nicomycin Z. And that was of interest to me. I was unaware of that.
There are human trials, is that what you're saying?
It says they were getting ready to do human trials, and this was in April of 06.
Oh, well.
So maybe they're underway, and I'm unaware of it. But I had never heard of the drug.
Commissioner Earl, do you have something to say?
Yeah. Commissioner Craven, did they tell you where this work was being done?
It's the original work. It was published in article published April 12, 2006. The federal government is backing the first potential cure for valley fever, Nicomycin Z. No, it doesn't say. I picked this up online from DiseaseSummaries.com, I guess it was.
Amazing what you can find on the internet, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Commissioner Warren.
Yes, I attended the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board, and most of the discussion was in regards to cuts and the budget and what was happening with that, and Mental Health Services Act, prevention and early intervention. But again, some of that's still up in the air. but one of the things that they are looking at is a social host ordinance, and which is looking at setting for the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board to take a position statement on how they feel about people hosting parties that serve minors and how that would be handled. And they're working with Slo PD, and they have several people, the police chief and a couple of her officers have been in and talking with them, and Frank Warren's working with them on that. And they're looking at what other ordinances are out there throughout California. It seems every community kind of develops their own. But San Luis Obispo, the city of, is one of the first ones in our county that's really kind of looking at what kind of an ordinance they would develop, because you can't really hold people accountable if you don't have an ordinance that says this is what you've, the line that you've crossed, and then this is what's going to happen. So I'm glad there's finally some discussion around this, and so it's really right now they're in the investigative stage, looking at the different policies that other communities have, and talking about contacting Cal Poly, working with them. And at the same time, there's also one of the members that's looking at education of bartenders and, you know, when to say no with a client, a consumer who's consumed too much. And so they've got a couple of things going on, and looks like maybe they'll set some precedents here and get some real active things happening.
Speaking of that, for the bartenders, I just read, I don't know where I read it, that if you have an iPhone now, there's an attachment that you can do a breathalyzer on your iPhone.
Okay, I guess we're done with the commissioner reports. Committee reports, do we have any committee reports? I think we were all pretty busy. Community education?
No, we haven't met, but Public Health Week is in April, and I just was doodling on my thing and thought maybe a good suggestion would be health care in hard times. You know, maybe approach it from that. And since we're not having a commission meeting in February, I may try and get the community ed committee together to meet, so that there won't be any free month.
So when you said health care in hard times, are you thinking that being a subject for a meeting or a subject for educational materials?
I would hope both. I think it would be a good public health month meeting. You know, April is a couple months away. The budget's not going to probably get solved by then. The national level with the new president might give us some impetus for creative ideas. So I guess that's what I was thinking.
Okay.
And that, I mean, subject to change.
I think that sounds innovative.
Okay.
Commissioner Warren, did you want
to? Yes, and I'd like to work with Commissioner Hetherington on that, because there's been some changes in state and federal law on screening and brief intervention in the trauma emergency rooms, for the docs to be able to ask the questions about whether or not there's a problem with any kind of substance abuse. They wouldn't get paid for it before if they asked those questions, and they put that down as any part of a problem, and that's changed. And it's changed here in the state of California in October. So I'm curious, talking with some of our emergency room doctors to see if what kind of an impact that type of a change would have for the referrals and the screening and all of that.
Would you help with that, Dr. Borenstein, as well?
So I'd like to suggest that all commissioners maybe provide input on that. Think of some area that's your area of expertise and what or your area of interest, and what might be happening in hard times and where are the resources. We heard tonight, certainly there are resources out there. All is not doom and gloom. There are some positive things going on as well, and we need to keep our eyes on that and move forward. Any other committee reports? No nominee. Okay. All right. Well, then we just spoke about prospective future items, which was the next item on the agenda. We will be having a meeting in March, cancer prevention, cancer awareness. That will be the overall subject of our meeting in March. There is no meeting in February due to the several county holidays. But according to Commissioner Hetherington, we're going to have an education committee meeting, so we still get to go to a meeting. Is there anything else that anybody would like to comment on or say at this meeting? Otherwise, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
That's a record, I think, isn't it?